Welcome to Ripstop on the Record, the podcast for makers, by makers, where we talk about all things MYOG. Brought to you by Ripstop by the Roll.
I think it's good, right?
Yeah, I think that was a good take.
Hey everyone, welcome to Ripstop on the Record. I'm Jameson.
And I'm Avery.
In this episode, we'll be talking with senior soft goods developer Daniel McEwen from Priority Designs. Now, what does a senior soft goods developer do? We'll answer that question in a few minutes when we get to the episode, but I'm going to intro a little bit to what Daniel does. So Priority Designs is a company that helps larger companies and different styles companies figure out how to develop their products in a more efficient and effective way. They've worked with companies like Rawlings, TaylorMade, STX, as well as various tactical companies and a lot of other things. And we're just talking about the sewing side. They do a ton of other things. Daniel ran his own company for many, many years, a successful bag company that he talks about in the episode, and now wants to tell us and tell you how you can make your MYOG into a business. So we'll talk all about that and more here in a few minutes.
And something really exciting that has happened here at RBTR is we've released two new DIY kits. So the first one we have is the packable poncho kit, which should be called the packable poncho / emergency tarp kit. It is a poncho that you can, make an emergency tarp, use it as a ground sheet. It's really cool. It's made out of 1.1 sil poly, and we have it in some great colors like black, orange, olive, gray, robin egg blue, and green tea. And then the other kit we have just released is the lay flat travel bag, and that's made out of a 1/6 sil poly. This is kind of it is what it is. It's a bag that lays super flat and you can fit a ton of stuff in. I got 21 rolled Ripstop shirts in it. It's great for muddy shoes, gym shoes, dirty clothes when you're traveling, or just whatever you need it for. So go check out our new DIY kits.
That is the do-it-all bag right there. Check those out.
And lastly, we're really excited for the new year in 2024. The products team has a lot of fun things up their sleeve, a lot of new products that we plan on bringing on, and also look forward to the maker sponsorship in 2024. If you're not familiar what that is, we'll drop a link in the show notes. Check out our social media because we will be opening up the applications for that in early January. But until then, make sure you like, comment, rate, subscribe. And also, if you'd like to follow along visually, check out our YouTube where you can see all of our podcasts visually and our new DIY kit tutorial videos that Jameson painstakingly made. So go check those out. Let's get him some views and enjoy the episode.
Hey, Daniel, welcome to the podcast.
How's it going? Happy to be here.
It's going great. So I'm really excited because we've never talked to somebody that does what you do. And although we will have introed you in the intro, I'm just going to help fill in the gap more. As a soft goods designer, what do you do?
I'm still trying to figure that out. So pretty much anything sewn, we design. So the place that I work, Priority Designs, is a industrial design consultancy, but we have a whole team. It's a 7-person team of dedicated soft goods designers, and we work across a bunch of different industries. So, sporting goods, industrial, outdoor, consumer goods, pretty much anything sewn comes through our department in some fashion. So my job looks a lot. One of the things I like about it is it's completely different every single day. So some days I'm project managing. Other days I'm, in the back, I'm sewing, I'm making prototypes, I'm doing, 2D renderings and sketches, I'm doing sourcing. So just a pretty wide variety of things. And that doesn't even, sewing is a good portion of it, but there's also a whole other side of it that's, laminate adhesives and sew-free technologies and stuff like that. So a little bit of everything. And I think that's probably one of the tricky things about, I guess, the title of the soft goods designer is it's hard to exactly pin exactly what that is because it kind of varies from company to company.
Interesting. I didn't think of the layers that all of soft goods can kind of entail. And I know that we'll dig a little bit more into that in a second, but how did you end up as a soft goods designer? What happened in your previous life that brought you here? Give us kind of a rundown of how you ended up where you are today.
Yeah. I think a lot of soft goods designers I've talked to, they kind of fall into it sideways. There's pretty limited traditional paths to soft goods design. Myself, I went to school for fine arts. I didn't think that I would be sewing for a living. That was not a plan that I had. I didn't do it when I was a kid. I'm jealous of people that did because they learned a lot of stuff before I did. But I went to school for ceramics, and when I was in school, I didn't have a car, so I was riding my bike back and forth, and I had just a cheap bag from like an army surplus store or something. And every time it rained, like everything would get ruined. So I was like, I bet I could make a better bag than this, than what I have right now. And with, you know, youthful arrogance, I was like, how hard can that be? You know, so I got my grandmother's sewing machine and I made a bag, and it was so bad. It's hard to put into words really like how bad it was. But it kind of lit this spark in my head of, man, I could probably do the next one a little bit better. Right. And so, you know, the next one was 50% better. And then the one after that was, you know, even that much better. And it started to really roll. And then someone saw that one. They were like, hey, can you make me one? It's like, sure thing. And so a company kind of grew out of that. Seagull Bags was the name. It was mostly around cycling and outdoor gear. Everything was waterproof, lifetime warranty type stuff. And that grew into, let's see, we had 15 people at one point. We had our own production facility. We had a full team. Yeah. And did that for about 15 years. And that experience, it opened the door into doing some consulting. So the thing that's really hard about soft goods and sewn products in general is right at the point where you're about to go into manufacturing is the point where a lot of these projects die and stall out. It's not as easy as, you know, sending a CAD file to a 3D printer and just something pops out. There's a lot that goes on in between those phases. So I started doing some consulting work, helping people design and get things manufactured the right way. And that's how I ended up here at Priority Designs. I was pinch hitting on a couple projects and I just kind of didn't leave the building. So kind of snuck my way in here.
So your sewing experience started with the bag. But I would imagine a lot of what you do is also like fabric application and it's a lot of fabric knowledge. How did you start? Did you learn a lot of that stuff from doing the bag company, or how did you bridge that gap to then understanding like why you'd want a laminate or a woven and nylon and all those things?
Yeah, that's a great question. Most of probably the first 10 years of being in the industry was just trial and error and experience, you know, just kind of like seeing who I could get to talk to me and give me information. It wasn't until, you know, started going to more trade shows and working on some larger projects where you can work with mills more directly that, you know, you kind of get a little peek into the black box, a little bit of material. And then also, you know, working at a place where you have people with a lot of different specialties. So mostly, you know, almost all of my background was wovens, really heavyweight materials. And, you know, right, I sit across from a woman who comes from the fashion industry. And so, you know, getting that information about knits and, you know, all the narrow goods that come with that, you know, that's how a lot of that has come. And the podcast that y'all just did about, you know, how you make material, that's great. I'm going to plug it, because if you're curious about how to get fabrics made and how that process happens, listen to it, because it's very good.
First of all, thank you. It's nice that we don't have to plug it. That's cool. that makes a lot of sense. So we wanted to ask a little bit about your background, which were the last couple of questions, but the kind of the main thrust of what we're kind of interested in talking to you about is this idea of helping people take something that they have, maybe a product that they have in mind that they really like or something that's really good, and turning that into like more than just an MYOG project, but into maybe a company or into a scalable product or a reproducible product. I don't know. You know what I mean? How you take your MYOG to a business, more or less, something like that. So what is the first hurdle that people need to make that? What's the first jump that you make to turn that into their own brand, I guess?
Yeah, I think the thing that, because we run into this too with product development and working with entrepreneurs that are doing this, and I ran into this myself. Perfect can be the enemy of good, right? So you're going to want to, stay in your basement and just like constantly and get everything perfect before you release it. And I think that there is some wisdom to that, but I think just putting stuff, like, it's easier now to just put stuff out in the world than ever before. When I started my brand, it was mail order. Like, you literally had to mail me a check, which like instantly dates me. I understand that. It's fine. But, it's so much easier now to, make a social media, account and start to put your stuff out there and start connecting with people that are into the type of gear that you're making. So if you're sitting there and you're like, man, I made some stuff for myself. I like this. Some other people have seen it and they like it. I'd say the first step is you're never going to get it perfect, especially if you're making it yourself. And keep it really simple and to the point. Know who you are, know what you're about, and your first offering should be pretty limited, right? It's really hard to control a full catalog and all the material purchasing and everything that's needed to support that on the back end. But if you start small and you're really, really specific with what you offer, you can have a lot of control, right? And you can even, let's say if you're into bike packing, you're like, I just really like a good saddlebag and that's what I'm into. If you come into the market with that and you don't try to come in with, a full suite of panniers and, handlebar bags and everything else, it's easier to make changes to your product. It's easier to pivot how you talk about your product in the market. But have a crystallized vision, I think, of what you care about and what you do, and a really simple product, and just put it out there. You're gonna run into these things. I remember doing this. I like worked on this backpack forever. And I was like, sweet, I've got it. I finally got it. And I released it. And it was like almost to the order. Like the first person pointed out some really obvious flaw with it. You're in like a cone, right? You can't see, like, you have blinders on. Getting stuff out there as quickly as you can, I think is really important. Even if that's, not straight to the market where you're selling it, but just, hey, I'm going to make 5 of these and send these to my friends to try out, because people are going to point out stuff that you wouldn't have seen before. Some of it's really cool and you get great feedback, and some of it's like, you can't be married to it too much because some feedback's pretty harsh. But that's what I would say. I mean, it's easier to do it now than it has been. So just being a little fearless, right, and just putting it out there, I think is really valuable.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It also aligns very much with like probably good business practice in terms of knowing who you are as a company as well. Like in terms of what you're talking about with the product, like it's important. Companies get dragged around a lot when they don't really know what they want to be as a company or how they want to function and how they want leadership to work and all that stuff. That makes sense. That could be very similar with products too. When you don't, somebody wants like but I want it to be a backpack, but I really want fly fishermen to like it, and I want someone to be able to commute with it on the train in an urban environment, and I would really like it if people could go hunting with it. And you know, like, yeah. We hear those stories all the time of people that are making, like, I really want a backpack that does it all, and that's why I'm making it. Like, that's super cool. You might be able to make that happen. You probably can't make that happen for like 200 units of that because, you know, your situation.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Like, I mean, the classic example is like the backpack that's also a sling bag.
Mm, yeah.
It's like this constant thing that you see constantly. And it's like what it ends up being is like, you know, like the first cell phone. So like, hey, we have a camera, but like it makes the cell phone worse and the camera's terrible.
Yeah,
for sure. Definitely.
So another question that I think a lot of people are trying to make this jump have is how do you design out those flaws? Like those things that you're talking, people point out your first orders, how do you design out the flaws and potential like warranty issues if you're making a lot of this stuff on your own?
Yeah. There's a lot of things to consider here. I mean, I think I'm going to echo a lot of the things. I think the podcast you guys had a couple of months ago with Claire Beaumont from Patagonia was really good. She had a lot of really good things to say. I think probably the best thing you can do is repair your gear as much as you can. Or, you know, if you made it, great. If it's something else, you know, if you have like an Osprey backpack and something happens to it, try and repair it. You learn a lot about your gear. So the company that I had, it was a lifetime warranty, right? So as long as the company was around, you send it back, we'll fix it and, you know, send it on its way. If it was beyond repair, we'd make you a new one. And it is unbelievable, right? Like we learned one set of things in the first 5 years, and then, you know, years 5 to 7, it was a completely different set of warranty issues, right? Now you're in the place where it's less about the manufacturing and more about you're pushing the constraints of the material itself, right? Mm. And then in years, you know, 10 to 15, you're in this spot where you're like, I think I can repair this thing one more time, but every time you repair it, you kind of damage it a little bit in the process, right? So I think designing out some of those potential warranty issues, another way of putting that would be designing out the flaws that will make your product not usable, right? Like, I mean, if you make something for yourself and you take it on like a bike packing trip and you're really far away from your house and something fails, that's a problem. So I think a lot of designing out these flaws is the fact that, you know, soft goods design and manufacturing, it's all about context, right? So I'll give you an example. So a lot of times we think, okay, this seam right here, this has this piece of, you know, this handle coming out of it. Let's use that as an example. And this is going to be where a lot of the weight is put. So I'm going to just sew over that a bunch, right? You're going to run into a problem, because you're going to pulverize the material, right? So like the context is really important. If you have another example would be if you have a really heavy weight webbing that you might need for stability or whatever that is, and you're sewing that onto, you know, a sil nylon or something really, really thin and flimsy, right at that point, you have a potential warranty issue, right? So the context is really important. So if we think about what the item is going to be used for, and then you start to plan your material stack up according to how that item is going to be used. So one example would be if I know that, you know, I have a seam right here on the side, and I'm going to have like the bottom of my backpack strap coming out of that seam right there, directly out of it. I mean, there's a reason that people use those little triangles, right, at the bottom of your backpack strap, because it's going to spread that load over a longer seam. So you're going to have a little bit of a less concentrated kind of warranty and tear point. But one thing that is good to think about, if you know that something is going to be, you know, pulled on a lot or jerked on, you can stagger those steams as well. So think about it, like, instead of just like continually going over the same place over and over again, if you have, you know, if you sew your webbing together and that's one stitch, and then you put it on your first layer and that stitch is just slightly inboard of that. And then you know, your tack stitch is just slightly inboard that. And then your build stitch, which, you know, you're putting your bag together, is inboard of that even. Then instead of having, you know, four stitches all on top of one another, you have four that are parallel to each other. You're going to get a way stronger seam there. So much of it is just about the context. If you can have materials that are similar in their weight or how they function next to each other, that's going to be really good. Now, if it's not a load-bearing seam, and if it's just a style line across something, it's way less important. But definitely, yeah, that context. And so, you know, once you have, typically what I would do if I'm designing a new product, some of the stuff that, you know, I've worked on is, okay, it has to hold up to 1500 pounds or something, like really intense industrial, you know, tie downs and stuff. We get the design, and then there's a whole process of just understanding how those stitches interact with one another and where the pull is coming from. So, you know, we see a lot of times the material failing at a point, especially where webbing is attached to it. That's one that we saw a lot. So staggering those stitches can be really good. Another one that we saw, mostly with fixing other gear that people would bring in, like, hey, can you take a look at this, is if you're pulling against your seam, right? So ideally, the best thing that you could do is pull, you know, the weight is getting pulled in line with your webbing or your stitch, right? But anytime you're pulling against it, you can run into some problems there as well, because you're like literally every time, if you top on some webbing onto a piece of material and then you're pulling against that webbing, every time you pull on that, you're weakening that material that much more. So, there's the context is important, and sometimes you have to chase a problem around. So there was a project that we worked on, and they had, you know, it was a specific constraint. It had to hold 400 pounds. And we basically, we got the stitch right. You know, we got the webbing right. Cool. We did the stitch. It didn't hold. Okay. Shoot. We need to look at the stitch a little closer. Got the stitch right. Awesome. Then it broke at the material. Okay. Shoot. We need to redesign that seam. Okay. We got that. Then the hardware broke. Shoot. You know, it's like, so sometimes you kind of have to go through a few different iterations. And that's another reason, I think, to just get products out there. As long as you're comfortable with backing it up and saying, hey, if we made a mistake, we'll make it right. Sometimes you just have to wait until those products come back to you. So that's really good. And then, I mean, anytime that you can look at people's gear, I mean, I know that we probably do this all the time anyway, right? Like, you know, when someone's on the street, I'm like, looking at their bag, you know, probably looks really weird, but like, you know, anytime that you can get up close and personal with other people's gear and, you know, look at the type of stitches they're using, look at how they're bringing those seams together. It's like, there's all kinds of little tricks, and a lot of those come at the factory level, and they're going to have the most experience. So yeah, I mean, understand the context, being really careful with, you know, what type of material stack up you have, because that'll ultimately too, that can affect the needle width and the type of thread you use. So there's just like, it's like a, you know, the dominoes can fall pretty quick. And then, yeah, just checking out as much as you can.
Is there a way that at-home makers can learn some of those like factory style sewing techniques? Because I'm thinking about some of the stuff that you're mentioning there, and it's not something that I see a lot of MYOGers doing. Like, even people that are very good at sewing, I put like awkward quotes around that, because like they can run a really straight stitch, or like they can work in tight margins. But I haven't thought about layering the stitch quite that well, because normally, like, yeah, I'm my seam allowances aren't that Like, I'm not working with, like, you know, millimeters there. I'm kind of like, oh yeah, I'm going to use a quarter inch seam allowance and, you know, it'll be fine.
I'd also chime in here because the whole time you were talking, I was thinking about a backpack that I have that's made from a large manufacturer where it's made out of a lighter weight fabric. And it's the only pack where, like, that top loop strap, like, I'm starting to see signs of that wear. Like you talked about the grosgrain or the webbing pulling in a different direction of the seam. Check. You know, not staggering the seam on a lighter weight fabric. Now, like, the top loop where you put most of that weight to lift it up to then put on your back, you know, that sees the most wear in backpacks that I've ever seen. So, like, check. So maybe at home makers and other makers or companies, large companies that might not be using those techniques, but I'm curious too. But yeah, what are some of those techniques that people could use?
Yeah, that's and you point out something really well. I mean, you know, even if a brand is really big and an international brand, it doesn't mean that they're going to land the plane on all this stuff, right? Like, if you think about it, you know, they might have a few hundred different styles coming out in a year, right? So it's like they might have certain products that are their marquee products where they unleash their designers on and they, you know, really go down. But then they might have more commodity products where it's like, yep, just put the handle in there like you guys normally do. And that's where you can get some problems, right? But the question you asked was, you know, how can someone that's making their own gear, like, I guess, like, expand some of their understanding in some of these things? Is that really?
Yeah, yeah. Because I guess a lot of us, looking into that question more, a lot of us learn to sew on our own or just kind of like from, like, traditional learning methods. Is like, oh, you see somebody else do that and you're like, oh, I'll try that now too. It's like very, or we had like basic, like, home ec teaching maybe, but our sewing is very raw. So it's kind of like, I can run a stitch. So I sort of put stuff together and it's more the curiosity. I guess I'm wondering if there are ways or what ways you'd recommend. I'm sure there are that you can have more refined sewing techniques, especially for people looking to create a company. They might want to have more specific, like, more than I just do a straight stitch down there and go back and forth a few times and call it a day, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's a great, like, there's definitely some, you know, some production equipment that makes it easier, right? Like a walking foot machine and things, you know, obviously programmable stuff, but not a lot of people have that, right?
So, yeah.
I'd say it starts first with the, your prepped materials. If you don't prep your materials right, you're chasing the problem around the entire project, right? So as much as you can, you know, develop your cutting skills and your prep skills. That, you know, we often talk about that if I haven't prototyped in a while or if one of us hasn't, the first thing to go is your cutting skills. It's really weird. I don't know why that is, but, you know, you're trying to cut something out and you're just like, all over the place. But, you know, having really good prep materials. And then this is something that is a direct through line from manufacturing. If you have good prep materials and you lay things out really cleanly in the order that you're going to do them. So what I like to do is by zone. Okay. So I'll have, here's all the stuff on the front panel that I need. It's all cut and ready to go. And it's like stacked up or it's in the order that I'm going to make it. And then here's my gusset piece. Here's all the pieces for that. Here's my back panel. What that allows you to do is take, it's almost like, you know, the sum, like the parts are greater than the sum, right? Like if you go and look, so some of the difference that we see, in American manufacturing, which is especially, you know, sewn goods, is behind a lot of countries in Asia. We have on a typical factory floor in America, there's fewer people that are doing more complicated steps, right? So they're trying to do a lot of different things. Maybe they're making an entire front panel with all the pockets and all this stuff. In Asia, you have a different calculus where they have way more people doing simpler steps. Now you can do that because, you know, the labor is staggered in such a way, right? And we don't have to go down that, like, rabbit hole, but they're able to have one person doing one stitch. And that's what they do. And that piece then goes to the next person and they, you know, do the next stitch. So, but you can kind of, you can do this, in your basement or your studio. If you set it up the right way, the only thing you're doing at one time is one stitch, right? You're just doing one straight stitch and you're kind of slowly piecing those things together. So you're not looking at a project like, okay, I've got probably, you know, 30 different pieces here. Where do I even start? How do I, you know, like it? So one thing that we can think about, is setting up your products so that they are highly repeatable with the least amount of concentration, right? So if we think about, you're going to have, you know, 8 of your 10 steps are going to be super straight, super simple, right? And you might push all of the complexity in your project to like one stitch. That's really hard. So I always talk about like, oh, I got an example. I did bring visual examples.
Yes.
Okay. So this is a bag, that I did for a project, right? And it's like a soft, kind of soft-sided, but hard bag. Pretty crazy, pretty complicated looking, right?
Definitely.
But this, you know, this panel here, this is just a rectangle, right? With bar tacks on it. That's simple. You can repeat those over all day. You don't have to think about it. Same thing with the side panel. Yes, it looks complicated. Like there's this integrated handle, you know, on the side and there's more like Molly and stuff. That's really simple. That, like, you can do that once you break those steps down. The back panel, the same thing. It's really simple. Simple yoke system. I mean, the straps are kind of complicated, but Avery's laughing at me. She's like, sure, okay. But, you know, like, it's like if you really look at each one, you're like, oh, that's just a straight stitch right there. That's not hard, you know? Or like, oh, that's just, you know, that's just flipped and turned. Like, that's not a difficult process. But I'll tell you, this, the last step of sewing this top seam together, that was a beast, right? but it was kind of planned that way, right? So we planned it so that it's basically all flat panels. It gets zipped together, and then you have just one horrible seam that you have to worry about, instead of having to do that across the entire bag. So it's like, it's hard because you want to jump into doing the cool stuff and like making the bag cool right away, but it's all about the building blocks. Slowly just building the product, and then there's like one seam, and then you flip it right side out, and it's done. And you kind of, it's like kind of magical in a way, like you can't believe that you made that, which is cool. Does that help?
I mean, definitely. That definitely helps me too. It's just made me laugh hearing you describe it, because I feel so similarly, like trying to describe projects to people. And my roommate knits. I was like, what is it, crocheting or knitting? She knits, and I'm like, man, that just looks so hard. Like you're out there 5 hours an hour in front of the TV, and then it took you 3 weeks to make a whole sweater. Like, I mean, that's impressive to me. And she's like, well, you sewing a backpack, that looks hard. And I'm like, well, she's like, knitting is just a square. And I'm like, well, sewing a backpack is just a square. Like, I can fight you on that one. But I really, hearing you describe that makes me think of my experience, and I'm sure other people's experience of using patterns. Like, maybe you've made the same fanny pack, but use multiple different patterns. You know, and sometimes I'm like, the first fanny pack I ever made was our pattern. And I was like, well, sick. This is like three stitches. You know, you got the bottom corners and the zipper, and we were pretty much done. And I've done other fanny packs, and I was like, wow, this has 17 panels, and I'm halfway through it, and I'm mentally over it now. So I really like thinking that way of maybe trying to do that one major complicated step at the end versus sewing together the front panel, the two sides panels, the bottom panel, the back panel. And then that's like so many more seams you would have to potentially unrip other than that one gnarly seam at the end. But Yeah, that makes me like think about my making process in a different way.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's exactly right. It's the same thing with, yeah, I watch people knit and I'm just like, what are you doing? How is this possible? Like, it literally makes no sense to me at all. But yeah, it's a lot of times too. So if you're looking at a product and you're, you know, trying to think like, okay, how can I make this in the simplest way possible? And you're thinking about, okay, I know that I'm going to have maybe one seam at the end where I'm bringing it all together and there's padding and there's all this material and there's, you know, it can get really messy. Then you can think about, how do I hide that seam? Right. So the worst thing that you could have is you design a product where the last step you do is like the most consequential and visible part of it. You know, so you make it all the way up to this point, and then the last thing, if you blow it, you blow the whole project. Right. So if you can avoid that, you're already off in a good direction. And you know, it is similar to knitting in the sense that a lot of small actions add up over time. You know, like the cutting and the prep and the organizing, that most of the time takes like 75% of the time to prototype for me. It's just that, just getting it ready and getting everything set. So I know that once I get into it, I'm not missing something. I'm not, I don't have pieces that are cut out really wonky that I need to try and, you know, adjust. And that the same thing goes for patterning too. Take the extra time, put in a few registration marks for yourself, you know, make sure that, you know, you're, you know, just mark your centers. Like it's not, that doesn't take a whole bunch of extra time, but it's so worth it in the end. So it's just like a lot of little steps. And that's one thing, you know, if you look at a production, the production bag, all those things are there. Like if you pull the binding off and you look at, okay, there's little notches where all of the straps go in. There's notches at, you know, both the center points of the bag. There's notches, you know, where the logos go. It's that stuff is all there because they design it in such a way that someone that they bring in just to sew, they don't need to know about, you know, how the whole bag fits together and everything. It's like, they just have to know that one step. And that can like, it's frustrating because like when I make stuff, I just want to like get back there and just start tearing it up. Right? You know, just like, so I'm like, yeah, let's go. But it's like most of the time when I do that, I don't think something through and I get to the end and I'm like, oh no, what have I done? but it's worth the time. It's worth the time at the beginning.
Absolutely. So speaking to one thing that you just said, and I think the universal truth in sewing is that it does take 75% of that time to just cut the project. But let's say, and there probably is someone listening to this, and majority than not, that they're a one-person shop, or maybe they're just doing this for fun, but they want to make more. How would someone optimize their sewing production in a day to maximize profit margin, right? You've talked about kind of combining a lot of steps into one step or making sure all your cuts are right before you get sewing. But what would you say to someone who's looking to optimize their production or their output, but also maximize their margins?
Yeah, I love this question. Because whether there were, you know, different phases of the companies that, you know, I started, and they were just me by myself, me with a couple people, me with a big team, and then me back to myself. Right. So, I would say the first thing you want to do is kind of turn over every rock to look for efficiencies. So that's in cutting, that's in making, that's also in taking orders. That's in social media posts. That's all of it. So, you know, that's the one thing, even though it's easier to put a brand out there now, there's so much more that's expected of you as well. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you have to have an Instagram account and a TikTok account and a website and a Facebook and a Shopify website. And, you know, it's like, you have to have so many things that you're trying to juggle. So that's all stuff that takes away from you actually making stuff. So, chances to like look for chances to make that as simple as possible, right? Like, I know a lot of people single kind of person shops. I mean, I did this too. They accommodate a lot of requests, right? That's a big one. Someone's like, hey, I really like this, but can you make it, 2 inches longer? It's like, yeah, you can, but is that worth it for you? So there are some decisions like you have to kind of dig into, or is there a way that you can price it so that it is worth it? Or maybe that's your whole business model is just doing custom stuff, right? And so you have to price things, to match. And then when we get down to the production side, anytime that you can bulk cut things, or just like, hey, this is the day I'm going to cut stuff. You just break your tasks up so that you're not juggling back and forth, because that's where you make mistakes and you really lose a lot of efficiency. So, one kind of concept in manufacturing is like every time that you touch something, if that's material or a pattern or a part of a bag or whatever, you add time to it, right? So if I cut 5 bags and then I say, okay, here's all my cut pieces and they're stacked by that piece. Okay. And I say, well, I'm going to then take them and then stack them up by one whole bag here, one whole bag here. Every time you touch that material, you add time to it, right? And that stacks up over a project and, over 10 products. So one way to add a ton of efficiency is to just have your system set in place before you start. So I know actually, before I took a tour of the Kitspo facility before, it shut down. Super cool. Like they had, incredible equipment. It was really awesome to see. But they did something that was really kind of ingenious because they did all like one-off things. Like you ordered a shirt and they went and made it. And they had basically, it was like a baker's rack, right? Like you'd see in a kitchen with trays on it. And on each tray, it was all of the fabric for that with an order on top of it, right? And so somebody just walks over to the thing and they take the tray off. It's like, and that's all the stuff that they need for that. And they take that tray to, this is the production line for this piece of this specific garment right here. These are the 5 machines I need in order to make this. So it's like they, obviously they had a huge facility. A lot of us don't. Like I have one machine in my basement, right? So, but you can still take a lot of those principles in there by breaking up your tasks so they're like discrete individual things and not adding a bunch of time by just like kind of like stacking and restacking and moving and, especially when you get up into that place where you're starting to think about, I want to do this full time. I would love to take my products and sell them full time, even if it's just to support myself. You can't do it without those systems in place. It's just impossible. It's so weird. It sounds so weird, but one of my favorite like rabbit holes in YouTube is like that show, how I made this or how it's made or something. You can get so many like little nuggets for just like, hey, this is weird how they like transfer these croissants from this like machine over to this one, right? Like you can pick up on these like little things. And so those efficiencies become super important because even to make it worth your while, like your product might have a ceiling in terms of price, right? Like a handlebar bag, you can't say this is $400. Someone might buy it. I don't know, but people won't, So like getting all the system dialed is really going to help with that. And it's going to make your job a lot easier too, because it's less like of this cognitive load of trying to track a bunch of stuff. Like things are just in neat piles and they're organized. Yeah.
We've been talking about this in terms of like someone running their own company, but I'm even thinking about my own, the stuff that I make just personally. And the employees here can't like sell, like we can't have our own cottage companies, kind of a conflict of interest, but I do a lot of making on my own. And there are definitely ways that I'm thinking about it right now, where I could definitely be more efficient with my individual making even. And that sounds awesome too. Like I was in here on Friday. Yeah. I came in on Friday cause I just got a new bike rack and I wanted to make like a specific like bag for the rack. Sweet. And didn't take an enormous amount of time, but like probably worked on it for 6 hours. Like it wouldn't have been bad if that took less time. Like that's still, that would still be a big plus, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's like, and you know, all the time I'll like think of something and it's like, oh shit, I need this for a trip like tomorrow, you know, yeah. And like run downstairs and just start like sewing and it's crazy and it's like half baked and crooked. But yeah, I mean, one of the best things is if you can like cut and prep stuff and just let sit and then come back the next day, like for making your own gear, there is something like, it's a really nice like break to not expect that you just sit down and make something in one session. Yeah, that's like huge.
Yeah. So we've talked about your job and what you've done a bunch. And I think that there's a lot of people listening that will, that are probably pretty intrigued by what you do. I mean, everyone that is listening to this podcast is a maker to some extent. And even I was thinking about it and I like my job. I'm like, man, that job sounds really cool. So I want to talk a little bit about, the soft goods designer, and what that, you know, how do you become one, I guess, first of all, for people listening, that might be interested in this, that have, you know, let's say they have a lot of making background or even a little, how do you get into that? What do you need? What would you say to someone looking to join that industry?
Yeah. That's an awesome question. I think that there's three paths into it, right? There's your traditional industrial design background. Like you go to school for that and maybe you have a focus, in industrial design. Like there's a woman that works here and that was her path into it. She went to industrial design school, but was just really into backpacks. So she focused on that in a lot of her projects. And, you know, it was pretty clear, right, that she kind of built a lot of knowledge, you know, while being in school. So that's one path. The other one that I've seen a lot is a fashion design. So if you think about, if you come in through the industrial design door, that's going to be a lot of, you understand how to do 2D sketching and rendering, and maybe you have some 3D CAD abilities that are thrown in there. Whereas a fashion design, it's more what we call a tech designer, right? They know how to pattern really well. They know about, you know, how to make tech packs, how to do factory communication and work with vendors, right? So slightly different paths. And then there's the side door, which I think a lot of people take. And so I've thought about this too, because especially, you know, over the pandemic, there was just crazy shakeup, like in particularly the outdoor industry. I mean, it was like people were moving around like crazy and, you know, places were hiring like crazy. And, you know, I remember, I think it was on like an Office Hours podcast or something. And they were talking with a recruiter from Cotopaxi. And she says, you know, sometimes for some of these open positions, we might get 2,000 applications, which is just mind bending. Right. And so it's like, if you're thinking like, well, how do I become that? If that's the type of competition, right? And so this side door, this other way is really interesting. So just, I wrote a couple places down. So probably within a 5 mile radius of our office here, there's a place that makes custom awnings for like restaurants. Okay. And that, you know, it's like those things out front, right? The end of like the breezeways and stuff. They make those there. So that's a lot of sewing. That's CAD. They have a couple industrial designers that work there. But they also have a facility, a production facility. There's an automotive upholstery place that does cars and motorhomes. And there's a place that does, like custom, mascots. Okay. Super weird, like really different. But you know, if you stop and look around, you're like, there are so many sewn products everywhere and someone had to design it. And it had to come from somewhere. So like, let's say you want to get into like the outdoor industry, or, you know, you want to like work at an ID firm or something. It's really worth it to just take a minute, lift your head up and look around and see what's out there. Because people want to see that, like, you know how to make stuff, you know how stuff goes together. So, one of the women that works here, she learned how to sew at a domestic, production, backpack facility. Right. And so just the fact that like she knew how stuff goes together, right? Like, that's like the biggest hurdle. If you want to, if you break into that, you know, into those type of roles, I think being willing to pursue kind of building a diverse resume is a really good idea. There's so many opportunities out there, or like there are hundreds of production facilities in the States, and each one of them, they need people that sew, and they need people that sample and prototype and design the products, right? So it's like, look around and see what's around you. Like, there might be a production facility like right in your backyard and you don't know it. Cause a lot of times they don't have great websites, or they don't like, you know, have big like flashing signs, like production sewing facility, right? But they're there. So yeah, being willing to go and kind of get your hands dirty. So that's like, you know, if you're thinking about it and you're in school and want to go the ID background, that's great. You can build a lot of skills. Or if you want to take it in the fashion background, you're going to build different skills, but they're also valuable. Or yeah, just be willing to try in different industries and just kind of, you know, expand your vision a little bit to see what's out there. And a lot of people end up, you know, eventually like in the place, or, you know, maybe they are like a, you know, senior designer, like at an outdoor company. But if you go back and look at their resume, it started somewhere else, right? It didn't start like at that level. It usually started kind of in a different way. So that's, yeah, that's how like breaking into the industry. That's definitely, something I would think about. And then, yeah, in terms of like getting noticed, right? I mean, having, you know, looked over hundreds of resumes over the years, like the being able to show something you made, it's like, that to me is the pinnacle, right? Like, that is the top. If you say you can have all of this like industry experience and it could be really good, but just showing like, hey, I made this. Here's the process. Here's the sketch. Here are my patterns. Here's the finished product. That is so powerful. Like, yeah, just be willing to kind of to try to do the entire process like that. Document it. And that's what you show. That's huge. Cause it's really hard to teach that unless you just done it, you know? So if I had a choice between someone who is fresh out of design school, really perfect renderings, and someone who, maybe the renderings aren't as perfect, but they made their product, I would take that person. Like every time.
That's really fascinating.
Question.
Yeah, no, that definitely does. I guess we think in a lot of ways. I mean, like I said, I'm not a company at all, but it just makes me reconsider how I make my own like MYOG products, which is kind of cool. And I didn't expect to leave with that insight today either.
I was going to add in one more thing here to this as well, but also went to art school in Atlanta, and there's also another very well-known art school in Atlanta. And I went to just, you know, regular public college, but our professors were always like, you guys will get picked over any job versus the art academy, because they had, you know, the Mac aquarium and all the nice equipment. And we were like over here working with like tinfoil boxes trying to take pictures. And they were like, yeah, you guys, you're so scrappy. But that's true. Like, I mean, I get on TikTok and I see like hacks on how to do things faster without buying a $30 attachment to bind your seams and add grow grain. But that just instantly made me think of that like, you don't need the fanciest machine. I mean, walking foot machine is really nice, but yeah, I mean, you can get scrappy in other ways, and yeah, just not letting these constraints hold you back, I think is super, super valuable. But yeah.
Yeah. Totally. And to that, like being willing to be scrappy and like make a bunch of different stuff, right? So like, you know, just showing like, here are the 10 different handlebar bags that I made. It's like, that's great. You clearly like understand how stuff goes together, but like, here's that. And then here's this upholstery job that I tried. And then here's this like windshell or rain shell that I made. And here, you know, it's like, being willing to try all that different stuff, because you just learn every time you take on a new project like that, you learn so much. And you normally gain a lot of respect for people that you follow on Instagram. You're like, oh my God, how'd they do that so well? But yeah, that's another way too. Just like be willing to kind of stick your neck out and try new stuff. You know, that's huge.
Yeah. I feel like I learned a lot when I sewed my first apparel project, like a lot more than I did on my seventh backpack. And like, yeah, the backpack was a lot more complex. Like, it was not a difficult apparel project, but just the fact that it was so new and so different, and a serger, and I had to think about like the, you know, the drape, like it was cool, but it was such a weird, yeah, like a backpack doesn't scare me at all now. Not saying it's going to be an amazing backpack, but like the concept of the backpack is not scary, but like the new pair of shorts sounds hard. That sounds scary.
Oh, yeah. 100%. Like I am the same, like it's hilarious. So one of the tech designers that we have here, the whole experience is in apparel, right? And I'm just like watching, like, how do you do that? Like, so, you know, my whole experience is in heavy duty wovens and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, it's in this reverse. She's like, I don't understand how you can work with that material. And I'm like, right back at you, because yeah, it's like real lightweight, like, yeah, super stretchy materials. They like give, yeah, me an anxious, like, oh, breakdown, basically.
Yeah. So we have two questions for you in closing.
Yeah.
One is kind of our, like, we ask a lot of people this question, so I'm sure you'll be familiar with it. But first, as someone who looks at companies' designs all the time, I've noticed this in myself, and I don't have the expertise that you do. I've become very critical of a lot of companies that I've seen out there now, how they put stuff together, the fabrics they choose, the hardware they choose, you know it. So are there,
yeah,
what companies do you like? You know, when you become so ingrained in this, you become really picky. So what are companies that when you look at, you're like, I really like the way these people do this, or how they choose things, or do you have any?
Oh man. Boy, I mean, that gets to a root of like, I need to work on being a more hopeful person anyway, but like, I think, I mean, obviously the top for me is like Osprey. It's just, it's incredible. Their material selection, their patterning is, I mean, especially on their back panels of their larger through hiking bags, it's like, it's mind bending. It's magic. They are to me, like, they're at the very top. In terms of like more apparel and material, I mean, obviously, you know, Arc'teryx has got some just incredible stuff. Like their sense of color and material, I think, is probably some of the best out there. Some of their cuts of their things are a little strange, but you know, in terms of the materials, it's pretty incredible. And then, I mean, something that's kind of a little bit left field, but I guess makes a lot of sense, is there are some incredible smaller, Japanese brands. And I don't have them right in front of me right now, but you know, it's just a different set of considerations, right? Like the attention to detail, and just, you know, where they put pattern breaks and how they might combine two things that you wouldn't think would work, like a Dyneema composite material and a leather, you know, and you're like, that shouldn't work, but somehow this, it does, and it's confusing, you know, and I need to go for like a walk around the building because I can't understand it, you know, like, so that gets me hyped up. I mean, like, I like that stuff a lot, but I mean, one thing that's been definitely, I've been thinking a lot more about, and just, you know, being on some projects that have a larger sourcing component, you know, where you're helping a client order, you know, 100,000 yards of some material and designing that material. I mean, sustainability really is like, it's super important, and it's just becoming more important. And so I think the brands that are really taking that a little bit more seriously, whether that's the warranty or the type of material they use, like, I think that is really valuable. And it, like, and even, you know, working on materials that, or working on a product where the materials can be dissolved in steps. Like, we were talking with a client, and that was one of their considerations. Like, we can't just recycle this thing because it's all integrated, but we're actually going to make the material stack up in such a way that you can dissolve it in stages, which is kind of crazy. So
that's
really cool. And a lot of it's coming, which is great. But yeah, I'd say, those are the companies I get really, really hyped on.
Yeah. So this last question is kind of our flagship question, and I think I need to adjust it a little bit for you because you're too knowledgeable. The base question is what fabric is missing on the market, but what you just mentioned is that you're used to being in an environment where you can pretty much develop any fabric, so there's no fabric missing on the market if if you have the access, maybe. But what fabric that is generally attainable for most people, what is missing for you?
Oh man, that's a great question. So, I mean, not to sound like I'm sucking up or anything, but so the stuff that Ripstop by the Roll like brings to the table is incredible. I mean, so when I started, there wasn't anything like that anywhere. And it was really frustrating because you would have, you know, basically Cordura, and then anything else, any other high performance material, you couldn't get your hands on as a single maker. And that was really frustrating because you'd have these ideas and you couldn't make that stuff. So that's like, that's huge. I think, boy, okay, this is going to be a little weird, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. I'd say the biggest issue that I've seen with materials is in the webbing category. Okay, so let me throw this out there. So we work on a lot of sized projects. So some of them are really ultra small, right? And they're like, I just need a prototype. Some of these are Fortune 500 companies and you're doing this enormous project for them. But the consistent thing is every place has a different type of webbing that is a different weight, slightly different width sometimes. The colors are different. They have different names. And you know, different lead times and different MOQs. So you're in this spot where you're like we made this, we just had to make this big binder. And it's like, got here's all the places we know that have webbing. And so when you can flip to it and say, that's the one I'm looking for, because you know, what you'd call like a flat weave nylon is different every place you go. Yeah. So it would be so cool if it was like standardized in some way, or they could like somebody could figure out some way of showing, like the little videos you guys have on your site of like crumpling the material.
Yeah.
I love that. Like, that's so cool because it kind of shows you how it's going to function. If somebody could figure out some way of like standardizing or like, okay, here's how we talk about webbing, that would be awesome. And then if there was a clean line from, I can purchase 1 yard of this, but then, you know, so a problem we run into is like, yeah, we can get 100 yards of this, but when it goes into production, they're going to need 40,000 yards like every other month. So how do we, like, you know, some kind of through line where it's like, you can purchase small amounts, but it's really easy to scale that up just by like, you know, turning a knob basically. So that's webbing. Maybe it's just because we've had some drama around webbing recently that I'm saying this.
We have two, actually, believe it or not. It's like we have two. I'll just leave it at that, I guess. But also with webbing, it always goes along with the components then too, which can also be a problem. Like, maybe this is just me because we have somewhat limited components compared to like, you know, all of the Wujin or all the Duraflex stuff. But you find the right component and you're like, it's not the right size. It's 15 millimeters and I need it to be, and you're like, but that's the right piece. Like, I want that piece. And it's like,
it's like you wish you could like, honey, I shrunk the kids, like, and put it in the microwave.
Yeah.
It's a little smaller.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Like, I mean, to your point, Avery, about being scrappy, I mean, that's huge too. Like, we just had to do a thing. Like, I knew exactly the piece that I wanted, couldn't find it in the right size. And I literally took like two buckles and like epoxy them together and like shaped it and like worked with another guy here, and it was awesome. Like he like shaped it down and painted it so it looked like a new buckle that doesn't exist, but it was like you couldn't find it. Yeah, I totally agree with you. It'll drive you crazy. So one thing that we have back here in the shop is we've got, I think last time I counted, it was like 10,000 unique materials and hardware and webbing. Wow. And so it's just like enormous catalog, and we try and keep them in multiples if we can. So like we call it going shopping. Like you just go back there and like kind of leaf through like all the hardware, and most of the time it's pretty close, but we still run into those problems. You know, it's unavoidable.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we have a hard time stop today, which it makes sense and is also sad because I want to be here forever. So maybe, I don't know, maybe this will be a part two. Maybe, I don't know, maybe we can figure out another, well, we could definitely come up with another topic, but yeah, maybe we'll find you on the podcast again. But Daniel, thanks so much for coming on today, sharing some time with us and sharing about what you do at Priority Designs. Thanks for sharing with everybody. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me. It's been super fun. I mean, I will take any chance to talk about soft goods with anyone, whether they like to or not. Definitely, if you have any questions, just reach out. I don't know, you can find me on LinkedIn or I don't know, MySpace or whatever. I'll help anybody out if I can. So
sweet. Cool. We'll talk to you soon, Daniel. Thanks again.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks a ton.